you know, we're at a point in time where everyone is kind of coming to terms that mm-hmm. anti-Black racism is something that has existed in our world, not just in the United States. And I think what is frustrating for me as someone that is running an organization where Black women are the center is how much Black women are erased from the advocacy, from the activism, from the need for justice.
Hi, I'm Amelia Mola-Schmidt, and you're listening to In Conversation with Radio Laurier. Today on our program, we talk to Monica Samuels, Executive Director and Founder of Black Women in Motion, a Toronto-based youth-led organization that empowers and supports the advancement of Black women and survivors of sexual violence. Black Women in Motion works within an anti-racist, intersectional feminist, trauma-informed, and survivor-centered framework to create culturally relevant content, educational tools, healing spaces, and economic opportunities for Black women. We sat down and talked to Monica about the empowering work she and her team do, the fight for an intersectional approach in today's activism and community outreach, and the importance of keeping Black queer stories at the forefront of pride. Thanks so much for joining us today, Monica. I'm super excited to hear more about what Black Women in Motion does.
Thank you so much for having me. I'll start by first telling you a bit about myself. So I'm the founder, of course, of Black Women in Motion. Mm-hmm. We've been in operation for the last 7 years. I'm a community worker. I'm a social entrepreneur. I'm an educator, a consultant, and Black Women in Motion is my baby. It is something that I believe that the universe has definitely called me to do. Mm-hmm. So it is a organization that's based in Toronto. It is led by Black women. It is led by Black survivors. And, you know, our goal as an organization is to really hold space for Black women, to amplify their voices, their experiences, mm-hmm. And make sure that they have the tools, the resources, the supportive networks for them to thrive. And we work within an anti-racist, intersectional feminist, trauma-informed, survivor-centered framework to, you know, provide educational opportunities, employment opportunities, healing spaces for Black women that, you know, have gone through a lot in life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they have the capacity to be more than survivors alone. And the organization is, how do we move beyond that? So how do we heal? How do we, you know, better show up for other survivors in community? But how do we really actualize our potential? And sometimes you just need the space where that can be nurtured. And our organization is really about providing those spaces for nurturing, for healing, and centering Black women's voices and experiences, of course.
Absolutely. So you, like you mentioned, you're the founder. So how did the founding of Black Women in Motion come about?
So I went to Ryerson University. I actually went to school for human resource management. So okay. I don't know why I chose that path. But at that time when I was, you know, graduating high school, I believed that that's where I was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to work at a program that provided, you know, work study to students attending Ryerson. It was called the Tri-Mentoring Program. Mm-hmm. And through that, I was able to spend some time in community. You know, when I was in high school, I spent a lot of time working 2-3 jobs. Mm-hmm. Because at that time, my mother and I were going through a lot financially. Mm-hmm. There was a moment when we were underhoused and homeless, and I didn't have a chance to really engage in community and in school life the way that I wanted right. to. So when I went to Ryerson and found out about the Tri-Mentoring Program, I was like, oh my God, this is a chance for me to really show up for the Black community, for Black women. So I spent a lot of time in the Jane and Finch neighborhood here in Toronto, mm-hmm. and I met such amazingly beautiful, inside and out, mm-hmm. Resilient, passionate, talented Black women during my time in that community. Mm-hmm. You know, but when I was hearing some of their experiences of human trafficking, their experiences of gender-based violence, their experiences of sexual violence, I realized that I needed to hold space. And I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I knew that mm-hmm. that we needed that at that time. So in 2013, you know, there isn't this wave. I don't want to say wave, but it was really hard to access spaces for folks like us and be unapologetic about it. Mm-hmm. you know, but we deserve that. I was doing my best to cultivate that at the time. So there was, you know, a micro grant that I happened to stumble upon that York University was offering. And I'm like, I'm going to apply and I'm going to create something. And, you know, I just never looked back after that.
It sounds like you've created such a great space for community and for people to thrive, like you mentioned. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about some of the workshops that you do in Toronto and the GTA. Some of them focus on topics such as media literacy. What was the inspiration behind introducing this critical skill as a topic for a workshop in the context of Black Women in Motion?
Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned, when I spent time in community and hearing about people's lived experiences, you know, before folks were even the age of 20, what they had gone through, and also how the community, what the community response was, which was basically victim blaming. It was erasure. It did not center the survivor in any stretch of the imagination. Right. So we created the Black Peer Education Network program. So what that is for 6 months, we hire survivors of sexual violence, and they undergo, you know, various types of training and development on things like bystander intervention, consent 101, media literacy, because, you know, sexual violence, of course, is something that is experienced by folks across race and gender lines. However, Black folks and Black women are disproportionately affected and disproportionately excluded from the narrative in terms of what a survivor looks like. So I wanted to bring survivors together to have conversations around ways in which that we can, of course, show up for them, but how do we hold community accountable? How do we educate community and really disrupt and dismantle rape and rape culture? And part of that involves the learning and unlearning, but it needs to also start with us. It needs to start with the internalized oppression, the internalized white supremacy that I have as a survivor in a Black body, and then taking that out into community and helping folks work through that. There's a lot of generational trauma in the Black community. There's a lot of trauma when it comes to our experiences with anti-Black racism. So the work that we do and the workshops that we provide to community, that we provide to our program participants, really talk about those intersectional experiences that we have as a people and how do we start healing and better showing up for each other. But we have to kind of unpack all of these layered experiences that we have as Black folks. So one of the things I wanted to mention in this interview is, you know, we're at a point in time where everyone is kind of coming to terms that anti-Black racism is something that has existed in our world, not just in the United States. And I think what is frustrating for me as someone that is running an organization where Black women are the center is how much Black women are erased from the advocacy, from the activism, from the need for justice. So I recognize that, you know, unfortunately, George Floyd's death, like he was a martyr. And of course, he didn't deserve to die. You know, no one deserves to have their life taken at all in that way, especially, but we recognize like how Black folks are disproportionately targeted by the state. But there was no uproar for Nina Pop. There was no uproar for Breonna Taylor. There was no uproar for Oluwatoyin, who was a Black woman that lived in Tallahassee, who talked about openly her experience of sexual violence and then was kidnapped and murdered. And this was recently. And there is this disproportionate like advocacy that happens where not all Black lives matter. And I think as an organization, and why I love and respect and I am because of Black women and I will continue to be because of Black women is because we recognize that when we're fighting, we're not just fighting for ourselves, we're fighting for community. And the educational workshops that we do is to also help folks understand on how they can better show up for all Black lives, right? Not just Black men, Black cishet men, but the folks that are on the front lines are Black women. The folks that are on the front lines are Black trans women. The folks that are on the front lines are Black queer women and gender nonconforming and non-binary folks. But they're not getting justice and they're experiencing immense level of brutality and violence and erasure. So when we're having these conversations, you know, around consent, around patriarchy, all of those things, it's so important to talk about Black folks with intersecting identities, right? Like, what does this look like for a Black person who is precariously housed or underhoused or homeless? What does this look like for a Black person who is an immigrant? What does this look like for a Black disabled person? What does this look, right? So it's so important that when we're having these conversations and we're recognizing that or folks are coming to terms with colonialism and white supremacy, that, you know, we're talking about folks' unique lived experiences and how those intersecting identities lead to further marginalization and trauma.
No, I completely agree. I think if there's one thing I've noticed is there's been more of an understanding of the intersectionality, and it's becoming a more frequently used and understood. And it's been a prominent kind of goal in scholarship and feminine and everything. But now people are finally starting to understand that this is not just about, you know, men or women. Let's look at everybody who's disproportionately affected by these forces.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the consent workshops, sex positivity workshops that BWIM does, and a little bit about the recent reaction from the Canadian court when they ruled that extreme intoxication as an exemption for sexual assault. What were your thoughts on that?
So our team, you know, we were still grieving after what had happened to Toyin. And then to hear that, as a survivor, that's a slap in the face. Yeah. As a survivor, what you're telling me is that justice does not matter for me. Mm-hmm. As a survivor, you're telling me that I don't matter. And then survivors don't matter. And survivors are not prioritized. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm disgusted, and our team was obviously disgusted by this. When you come forward and talk about like your experience of sexual violence, there is this lack of protection. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, there is this victim blaming, like all of the supports that you can access, all of the institutions that exist are deeply rooted in victim blaming framework. And, you know, it's apparent in our court system. It was apparent before that case. And I think it was really painful. Like, it was hard for us to really process as a team. Like, we're really going backwards. Mm-hmm. We're really, really going backwards. And we're really showing survivors. We're not supporting survivors. Like, we don't support survivors in any stretch of the imagination. And that affirms that. Mm-hmm. So that is why when we have our workshops on consent, it's so important that we talk about it in tandem with institutional change.
Yeah.
So our current sex ed curriculum is basically like in the 1800s.
Yes.
There is nothing on body positivity. There is nothing on understanding the body and being comfortable with self. There's nothing on consent. There's nothing on boundary setting. You know, our premier stance is on, again, young people should not be educated about their bodies. Young people should not be educated on like how to have healthy relationships, whether that is, you know, with your colleagues, with your peers, as well as your romantic partner or partners. Mm-hmm. How do people make informed decisions if our educational system, when it comes to sex education, is abstain? And if you do not abstain, you will get pregnant or you will get a sexually transmitted infection or disease.
That's what we learned in high school.
That is what I learned in high school. And right. So the work that the organization has done over the last couple of years, like my team, the participants, like we're still unlearning a lot of that toxic shit, pardon my language, right? Nope. Like we're unlearning that we have control over our bodies. We're understanding like the body's response to trauma. Yeah. And it's so important that we have a curriculum that is intersectional, that takes into consideration people's unique lived experiences and identities within the context of consent. It's important that it talks about consent, right? And it's important that we have these reflective conversations on like, how does our legal system, how does our police force, aka the mob, better show up for survivors and folks that experience this type of violence? And that's the work that we do. Mm-hmm. So when we're having these conversations, they're raw, they are survivor-centered, they are survivor-led, and it's about systems change. Like, we can't talk about the learning and unlearning and the educational pieces without saying that in order for us to really get to a point where any type of instances of sexual violence, of gender-based violence are eradicated, they need to be supported by institutions, by policies, by laws. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating doing this work and then having something like that come up, which contradicts which contradicts the work that we do, but also it's prioritizing the predator and the perpetrator of the violence. Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine. I mean, it's unfortunate because when government takes stances like this that show absolutely no support for survivors, it obviously alleviates off all the pressure off them and then puts more pressure on groups like Black Women in Motion to kind of deal with and help and heal, which I can't imagine.
And again, like it's trauma. So mm-hmm. not only do I have to continuously heal, because, you know, when you experience different types of violence, it's mm-hmm. healing is a continuous process. It's not like I went in the woods and I kumbaya'd and it's over. Yeah. There's so much long-term nurturing and care that has to happen internally. Mm-hmm. But then when you're up against like these systems and institutions that are basically spitting on you, mm-hmm. metaphorically, as a survivor, it's really hard and it's traumatizing. It mm-hmm. re-traumatizes you. Mm-hmm. So not only do I have to live and navigate in this body after surviving something that was so traumatic to me, was so traumatic to my being, I now have to live in a society where they're telling me that I do not, like actively telling me that I don't matter, that this experience didn't matter to them. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really hard. It's so challenging. And a part of our work is really like, how do we hold those spaces for people to dump and heal and dump in healthy ways? Because I also understand how vicarious trauma works in our community as well. But mm-hmm. we're up against so much. So not only the anti-Black racism that we experience on an interpersonal institutionalized mm-hmm. level, right? Then it's like layered with our experiences of patriarchy, our experiences with misogynoir and anti-Black sexism. And that is why when we're doing the work, when we're doing the advocacy, and we're talking about Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. If this isn't a movement that is led by Black folks with intersecting identities, not mm-hmm. just Black cishet men, our team is very reluctant to jump on that bandwagon per se, mm-hmm. or support it, because folks need to also understand that while, yes, as Black men, we experience a particular type of structural violence, mm-hmm. and I would never not acknowledge that as a Black woman. However, there is privileges in the sense of them, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. Of being a cisgendered heterosexual Black man, versus the experiences of Black women. So I'm saying this not to say that we need to be divided, but I think we need to understand our various types of power and privileges in this. Mm-hmm. So for us to actually be able to dismantle it and to change it and to transform these institutions and transform the ways in which that we engage with each other, we need to understand and unpack that. The work that we do addresses those things.
Mm-hmm. Just briefly want to touch on what's been happening right now. Has the pandemic and everyone's increased time online provided any like unique opportunities for outreach for Black Women in Motion?
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of conversations in regards to this. Mm-hmm. To be transparent, we are a team of 5 incredibly dope Black women who I love and admire dearly that work for free for half of the year. And we work for free, not just because, you know, as Black women, we're supposed to be nurturers and caregivers. Like, I recognize the type of stereotypes that have been passed down to us as Black women. Mm-hmm. But because we're also invested and we care about the work, mm-hmm. but also our current structures don't support these particular types of initiatives. And again, that is contingent on who's in office. Right. As you would have seen, the calls to defund the police did not work when it went to city council.
Yeah.
And there is a number of initiatives, a number of community spaces, a number of organizations, youth-led, not-for-profits that support young mm-hmm. people, that support Black youth, Black women, that don't have the resources to do so long-term. But the city has $1 billion for to over-police communities. Mm-hmm. And that's something that our organization is up against as well. Like, we do our work and it's contingent on grant funding, which is contingent on who's in office. But given what has happened or what initiated following the George Floyd murder, there has been a sudden outpouring of support, right? People are recognizing, like, oh my God, like, anti-Black racism. I just discovered this. This was a thing. Oh my God. And it's also in Canada. I did not know. And I think as the executive director, I've been having a really challenging time processing this because in my mind, I'm like, what shoe were you living under to not understand that this was happening in our society?
Absolutely true.
But also it's that mentality of, like, as long as I'm not affected, like, I'm not, it doesn't matter to me. And we cannot have or live in a world where folks have equal opportunity and equity and actually get justice if that is the lens that we are navigating in this world. And I've been grateful for the support, but I also recognize the support that we've been getting is as a result of Black death. It's really hard to process that. It's really hard to find joy, to find excitement that, great, I can hire more Black women. I could provide Black women with more resources and supports that they need and deserve at a time, especially when, you know, we're going through it, not just because of our everyday experiences with anti-Black racism, but also because of COVID-19. But it's still coming from Black death. And it's really hard to wrap my head around and resolve that internally. And it's an ongoing process. But we have been getting some support, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the visibility. Mm-hmm. I don't do this work, you know, just for me, right? I do this for community. I do this because we deserve to have access to resources. We deserve to have mental health related supports. Mm-hmm. We deserve to have access to employment opportunities, right? We deserve to have access to healthcare. We deserve those things. Everyone deserves, like, these are universal fundamentally, rights. Like, rights that we should have as a people.
Absolutely.
And not just Black folks, Indigenous community, POC communities, everyone deserves these things. Mm-hmm. But because of how society is set up, we don't have access. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful again that I can be able to provide Black women with some additional tools and supports. It's knowing where the outpouring of support has come from has been challenging. And it shows that there's an immense amount of work that we still have to do, especially in Canada. Absolutely. I think Canada, you know, is the covert racism cousin, and the United States is very overt. Like, you literally don't matter, and I will show you actively in every way possible. Mm-hmm. But I think this blanket that, you know, we've covered our country and that, like, you know, it's so diverse, it's so multicultural, like, it's absolute perfection is incredibly incorrect. Like, mm-hmm. Indigenous communities, we're witnessing genocide and have been for so long. Yeah. And why does that not matter to people? Mm-hmm. Right? Like,
it's timely that tomorrow is Canada Day too.
Yeah, we boycott that shit over here. So it's Indigenous People's Day tomorrow. But, like, to celebrate that.
Exactly.
Right? And knowing that it's the colonial violence. Mm-hmm. The lack of resources, right?
Yeah.
The RCMP's involvement in the missing and murdered Indigenous women and Two-Spirit folks and the violence. Like, there's nothing for me to celebrate. I think right now it is a great time for us to, as we all come to terms with this, as we all do the self-reflection work to understand our conscious and unconscious involvement in these systems, I think it's time to really think about, like, solidarity and, like, allyship. Mm-hmm. And what that looks like for Indigenous communities, what that looks like for POC communities, like, how do we show up for each other so we get to a place where all lives matter? Because right now, all lives don't matter.
No, it's true. It's
very clear.
I really found it interesting, the covert comment you made about Canada, because I think that's so true. We like to believe that we have it better here, that people have it better here, but it's not the case. And like you said, I don't know what shoe people have been living under to think that this hasn't been happening. And I think that's what's been frustrating for me too, is having these conversations with friends who are suddenly social justice activists when these issues have been happening for years and years and years. So I can't imagine how you're feeling.
Like, where have you been? Yeah. Like, I spent a lot of time crying. My team has spent a lot of time crying, being angry, like, going through every spectrum of emotion possible. Absolutely. But like, I'm in a space of like laughter, because I'm just like, it's really hard for me to believe like you did not, like you really thought Canada like mm-hmm. was it. Like, it's not.
No, I know. I can totally understand that. And last week, actually, on our podcast, we were talking to POC students from Canadian university campuses about their experiences with racism. And an important point that I thought was brought up by one student was his concern for the Black Lives Matter movement fading as we assimilate back to normal life, getting out of quarantine. Is this kind of the news cycle ceasing to report on it a little bit more? Has this kind of crossed your mind as a concern? Is this something that you've been thinking about and your team's been thinking about?
Of course, and it will happen. You'll have millions of people that are like, oh my God, we need to support Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. We need to better support, you know, Black queer folks, Black trans folks. Mm-hmm. And within 2 weeks, people are off it. People are like, I've donated my $5, my $20, whatever amount. Mm-hmm. I am not racist. I'm good. Like, I've done my part. Mm-hmm. And I think people forget about like racism, anti-Black racism, like it's perpetuated through like institutions, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's not just like the bias and the prejudice. It's like, how is that now enforced and upholded by systemically by institutions, whether it's our healthcare, whether it's our educational system, like a donation isn't it. So when people are throwing money at Black Women in Motion's way, I am always having a conversation. I'm like, so what are you doing long-term to ensure that there is representation in your organization, mm-hmm. that you are not perpetuating violence, discrimination in your practices? Yeah. Like, your board has no Black people on it. It's a board of 30 people, or your advisory committee of 30 people. Yeah. Like, your management team, your executive team, there is no representation there of Black POCs, nobody.
Yeah.
Why? Absolutely.
What about, I'm curious to what you think about every, like, companies releasing these statements about...
Sorry.
No, go ahead. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm really trying to be respectful and not go off so that you'd never invite me on this again.
No,
but
I'm...
Those
I'm
blanketed
happy.
Statements mean nothing,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
They mean nothing. Mm-hmm. And again, like, the whole reemergence of like Black lives suddenly being prioritized by folks, by corporations. I see it as, again, people are trying to capitalize.
Yeah.
Like, capitalism is so deeply embedded in everything that folks are like, okay, I need to jump on this. And then if I can get a Black face here, I can sell this particular product or get an influencer to push this. Like, it's, again, Black lives and Black wellness and Black justice is still not being centered. It's like, it's something people hop on and off. So I'm very cognizant. Our team is yeah. cognizant that people will, like, we'll lose 50% if we haven't already, if people interested in this movement,
mm-hmm.
right? So people would, like, I made my statement. I put the Black square on my social media page.
Mm-hmm.
I donated my $1,000 to an organization.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're back to business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no interest in working with, supporting, or buying from people with that mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been interesting hearing the conversation about this right now, just because exactly like you said, your board could be full of white people, but you're releasing a statement about how you stand in solidarity. So I'm guessing it's more about affirmative action is what the goal is.
Like, allyship is action.
Mm-hmm.
Allyship is a verb. Like, it's something that you practice. It's not just a designation. It's a continual process of showing up, of supporting and the dismantling and disrupting and the burning down of systems that have and institutions that have oppressed Black people,
mm-hmm.
Indigenous populations and POC mm-hmm. populations for hundreds of years. Right? I can tell you that I still go into certain spaces. If I'm going to a walk, even in my building, where folks will not get into the elevator with me because they are terrified of my existence, right?
Yeah.
And these are people that may be at the heads of boards. These are people that are working to support or in community that work with racialized folks, that work with Black folks.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't just stop at a donation, right? There needs
no,
to be
absolutely.
Ongoing education, learning, and unlearning. But I think what's so important in all of this is people needing to call it in. People needing to do the self-reflection work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ugly and it's messy, but it's so, so, so necessary. I think when people's automatic response is, I need to defend myself because
yeah.
I'm not a racist and I haven't done this and blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, I need you to shut your face. I need you to be quiet and listen.
Yeah.
And then sit with yourself and sit with the discomfort. And really unpack that and just be like, so why didn't I not say anything when this injustice was happening?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't thought about the privileges that I've had. Why? I haven't thought about the erasure and eradication of Indigenous communities. Why? Like, unpack it.
Yeah.
And you will cry. Like, I have a couple of allies in my network that I talk to, and it's, people are crying, people are emotional, people are upset. And that has to start with self. So you can't be, you know, making these blanket statements. You can't be saying that you are, you know, a real ally until you've done the work with self. It doesn't make sense. And it's not going to be authentic. It's not going to be genuine. And it's not going to actually move real systemic change if you are not constantly checking, constantly learning and unlearning. Like, it starts with you as an individual. And then we can expand out to, like, what does that look like with community? What does that look like collaboratively? But it has to start with the individual.
I think that's a great point. And so many activists, I think, and even I've been reading So You Want to Talk About Race, and there's a whole chapter about that, checking your privilege, actively doing it. It's not just once, it's frequently, and how you can be better. And I found that really powerful, because it's something that even myself, I can't say I've sat down every month and made a list of everything that I have so easily, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. I think this awareness is really positive, and I'm really hoping that people are going to start to be more cognizant of what's happening, like how they walk through the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, just one final question before we wrap up. Pride was started, of course, by the Black queer community, yet it seems that the critical part of this history is often left out of mainstream narratives. Black Women in Motion put on a fantastic series throughout the month of June called We Are Pride, discussing these stories. Was there a lot of engagement with this? Was there positive responses? It was super awesome seeing this.
Mm-hmm. And as I said in the beginning, like, I am because of a Black woman. Mm-hmm. I am because of trans Black women. I am because of queer Black women. I am because of femmes. And I will continue to be as long as they exist in my life and do the work that they do.
Mm-hmm.
And out of a lot of things that we've done over the last 7 years, that's one of the things I am most proud of.
Yeah.
And as I said before, like, it starts with me. I'm a cishet Black woman. I am mad. I am disabled bodied, but there are a number of privileges that I have. I am light skinned, right? So there is that colorism piece in terms of the rooms that I get into, the conversations that I'm able to have with certain folks because of that. And because of my body and, like, the ways in which I align with Eurocentric and mm-hmm. dominant, the dominant group, so to speak. I don't like using that word. People in our society. So when we were talking about this as a team, I'm like, it's so important that we consistently check in with the privileges that we have in our identities. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to hold space for the Black women, the Black trans women and femmes that, as I said, are on the front lines, that have led this shit since the beginning of time, since Marsha P. Johnson. And it's been beautiful, like, the just being able to witness and experience the power, the elegance, the grace, the resilience, the beauty, and the authenticity that is Black women across the spectrum of experiences has been wonderful for me as a person. I've been reflecting on it a lot as how our organization continues to move and to grow, and how we better show up and hold space for our Black trans and non-binary siblings and community. Mm-hmm. Folks have loved it. Folks have loved the imagery and the performances. And I want to keep doing that beyond Pride, right? Just, yeah, like, absolutely. Black Lives Matter. Like, it's not just a moment, 2 month period. It is year round. It is forever. That goes for our Black, queer, LGBTQ plus family as well. And I want to continue to consistently show up for them and hold space for people to hear them and to see them in all of their authenticity.
That's amazing. Monica, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. It was super fascinating learning more about Black Women in Motion and the work you and your amazing team do for the community. So thank you so much. Stay healthy and well, and happy last day of Pride for the month of Pride. But like you said, let's keep the dialogue going, and it's not over just because the month of June is over.
Yes. Thank you so much for inviting me here and holding space. And I apologize for the cussing. I don't usually do these talks without cussing, just a little bit, but
don't worry I'm about happy it at
that
all.
There is some reflection happening at your end and recognizing that this is a long-term fight. It's not just a moment right now. It's forever.
Well, thank you for that. Hope to hear from you soon. Take care.
Bye.
To learn more about the important work that Monica and her team do, please visit blackwomeninmotion.org. In Conversation with Radio Laurier is written and produced by Amelia Mola Schmidt. The song that we use is called Loopster by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.